And I feel like this movie really is about second chances. So I think it's a hopeful film. Even though the business is tough, you have to protect yourself. You learn how to do that without becoming jaded or bitter, because that's no fun to watch. I mean, you want to be the hero of your own story. And I think that's how I feel about my life and how I feel Shelley has navigated hers.
Welcome back to The Envelope. I'm Kelvin Washington. Happy to be here with you alongside Mark Olson, Ivan Villarreal. Another week of some great films, some great folks who are participants in these films. We'll go to you. We'll start, Ivan. Let's start with Pamela Anderson and The Last Showgirl.
Yeah, so this film is set against the backdrop of Sin City, and Pamela plays Shelley, you know, this veteran showgirl who is sort of at this crossroads in her life when this Vegas show that she's appeared in for years is coming to an end. So she has to sort of figure out what comes next for her. The film is directed by Gia Coppola, and it really sort of marks a reframing for Pamela beyond her sort of sex symbol status. You know, she's able to tackle serious subject matter, and she gives a really tender performance in this film.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing her. As you mentioned, it's kind of a different role. I mean, it starts off, as you mentioned, just the profession of the character, but I'm sure there's many more layers to this and her role and character in this. All right, Mark, going to you with John Magaro, September 5, not 5th, 5.
Oh, I didn't know. I've been saying 5th.
Yeah. Apparently, it's up for debate even amongst those involved in the movie, but officially September 5. So this is a dramatization of the 1972 Olympics hostage crisis, but it takes a very specific look where it's set in the control room of ABC Sports, who were there in Munich for live coverage of the Olympics and suddenly found themselves thrust onto the world stage of telling this gripping, gripping story. And this is like a behind the scenes look of that. And John Magaro, who I spoke to, he plays Jeffrey Mason, who was a sort of a newbie TV director, was meant to be covering sort of an off day of the Olympics and is sort of like thrust into having to deal with this very tense moment. And the movie gets into, you know, how do they make certain decisions? What are they going to show? What are they not going to show? How are they going to get that footage? How are they not going to get that footage? And so the movie's directed by Tim Fehlbaum, who's a Swiss filmmaker. He's made a few other movies, but this is really by far the one that's garnered the most attention here in the United States. And John is a, you know, kind of a journeyman actor. Actually, funny enough, was an extra in the movie Munich, which also was about the Olympic hostage crisis. And so how far he has come from that role to this one is just a really exciting journey.
I think it makes sense too that we're pairing these together, because I feel like news is at this crossroads. It's in this existential moment. So they're going to vibe off each other, I feel like.
This is a great point. I had a chance to talk to Peter Sarsgaard also in September 5. And he echoes that. Just the way we go about what we see on social media, what's being put out there, how do we balance that? Have we gone too far? Or should we show more or less? Really interesting conversation. But let's start off with you, Yvonne, and Pamela Anderson in The Last Showgirl.
Pam, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Well, you play Shelley, a longtime showgirl who must figure out her life again when the show she's been in for years is coming to an end. And I know director Gia Coppola has said that she cast you after seeing your documentary, Pamela, A Love Story. And I'm curious for you, when you read the script, like, was it clear to you that you were made for this role? Like, what were the parallels that you saw with your experience in the entertainment industry?
Well, I know somebody else probably could have played this character, but when I read it, I was like, nobody can play this but me. I have to do this. It's life or death. This just really sang to me. I could hear her voice. I could see what this movie was. So many parts of it really resonated with me. Of course, the nostalgia and the glamour and the showgirl element of all of it, and being bedazzled head to toe looked like a lot of fun. But the mother-daughter story and the, so much of it. It was just the first really great script I'd ever read. I mean, outside of, you know, Roxy in Chicago when I played on Broadway. But this was the first film script I ever read that I really resonated with. And I just was so relieved that I was given the opportunity to kind of pour my whole life into this.
Take me back to the moment you're told you're being considered for this. What goes through Pamela Anderson's mind?
Well, it kind of took a little bit of a road to get to me. It was sent to an old agent who turned it down within an hour. Wow. Then Gia Coppola said, there's no way Pamela has read it if she's just turned it down within an hour. So she contacted my son, Brandon Thomas Lee, wonderful producer, and he sent it to me. So I read it, and I just was, you know, making pickles, making jam in my garden. I was kind of reassessing some of the things I'd choices I made in my life, and I was kind of going through a transition too of just thinking about, well, maybe I just was never going to be able to show what I've got or see what I'm made of. And when I read the script, I was just like, oh gosh, this is it. This is it. This is my chance to do something, you know, I just do something as best I can. So I'm so grateful for it. And then I called her, we Zoomed. And I said, you know, I can do this. And she goes, no, I know you can do this. This is why I've been looking for you. Like, we were both selling each other. It was a really funny Zoom call. But then once it, even when she said I was doing it, it didn't feel real. And then I just started working on it like crazy.
As you said, you knew that you could do this. What did Gia articulate to you as to why she felt strongly that this was for you too?
Well, she said she'd noticed when she watched my documentary that I was a woman just, you know, just aching to express herself creatively, and that I had so much to draw from, and that, you know, I loved movies and film and, you know, poetry and philosophy, and I read a lot. And she just was like, this is a really kind of interesting woman. And so she had the vision, which I think is such a skill, because I think she could kind of weed through the nonsense and see me as a artist, which I'm forever grateful.
I want to talk more about that, because, you know, Shelley, as we see in the film, she really talks about how she finds joy in what she does and how this show has sort of, you know, in very many ways defined her. But she is at this juncture where she has to sort of rediscover herself at this point in her life and figure out who she is away from this place. And like you said, in your documentary and in your memoir, that was coming at a point where you were sort of at that a similar juncture of, you know, what's this next chapter going to look like? How do I want it to look? What do you remember about navigating that? And what was it that was keeping you up at night?
Well, I was looking at my own life and thinking, I don't want to be defined by what has happened to me. I want to be defined by what I do. And so there are parallels in our stories, but there's also big differences. And I could really empathize with her and putting her dreams first and, you know, thinking, you know, she never abandoned her daughter. She was doing what she thought was best for her. Even though she had let the neighbors raise her, she knew that she was in a better place than she could offer. And, you know, I could just resonate with a lot of things. Like, you know, I always say, you're going to meet your adult children and beg forgiveness, because there's no perfect way to raise a child. I mean, if you come from your heart, that's the best way to go. And she's all heart, wears her heart in her sleeve, is kind of a messy, you know, makes mistakes, but she's not a pushover. Mm-hmm. And so I could resonate with that too. And not that it kept me up at night, but I just loved the challenge. I thought that I could play this character with a lot of nuance and layers and really pour everything, all my life experience from childhood till now, into this character. There was a place for it all. And so I feel like it actually was such a relief to me. I felt like I could breathe after I did this film. I felt like at least it's somewhere. It's somewhere. It's something I can never write enough about or go to therapy enough about or talk to a good girlfriend enough about. I needed somewhere to put it, and so I was really grateful for this.
So tell me how, from the moment that you are told this is your role to shooting, how long was that gap?
Not long.
How did you spend that time prepping?
Well, I prepared a lot. I'm a hard worker when it comes to the roles I want to play, especially lately. And I work with a great acting teacher, Ivana Chubbuck, and we started going through it, and I prepared for it like I'd prepare for a play, because we only had 18 days to shoot the film. And so I knew I had to have it all in me, like not just in me, embedded in me, like just I had to have it in me. So I worked very hard. Before I even got to Las Vegas, I had it in my mind what I wanted to do. But then, of course, you know, it's the director, and you'd work with her, and we try different things, and also the cast. And I just wanted to be super prepared, but not over prepared that I wasn't flexible. I wanted to just come there with as much possibility and as much as I could.
So what did that look like? I mean, were you watching movies, or were you digging into, like, what did that involve?
Well, there's no shortage of me watching movies. I'm a big Criterion Channel junkie. I just raided their closet the other day, and I have, you know, all my favorite films. I mean, you know, Cassavetes or French films, Godard, or, you know, even I watched a lot of my favorite actresses. Like, I love Elizabeth Taylor in Suddenly Last Summer. I wanted to feel what that feels like, to just throw yourself into a character where you're risking everything and creating something memorable. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching actresses, but I loved even Jenna Rollins. And like I said, the Cassavetes films were great. And I just, I mean, I'm always watching films. I mean, if it's In the Mood for Love, it's like all over across the board. I just love film. And so that was part of it. But I also worked with a great choreographer, Gregory Butler, who worked with me on Broadway too. So that was fun to kind of come up with the audition scene together.
Together.
Yes. I watch a lot of the, you know, the Follies or any Ziegfeld and Showgirl thing that I could find, and all the photos and references. And we talked to the Jubilee dancers, and the dressers helped us figure out the choreography with the quick changes, because there's, you know, you take the head piece off and you put it on the mannequin. Everything is done exactly in the same order each time. And those are things I wanted to make it look like I've been doing it for 30 years.
Well, and they came to your home, right? Diane Palm, who is part of Jubilee, which is sort of the inspiration for this movie. But talk to me about what that was like, getting the do's and don'ts from the pros and having them in your home, sort of giving you guys a tutorial of sorts.
Well, even seeing some of the girls in person, they still walk with such grace. There's a showgirl walk. There's a way to carry yourself. They talked about, you know, they're not burlesque. I don't wear pasties, for instance. They are very proud of their art form and very proud of the times, very nostalgic, very, like, you know, they were treated like movie stars, and they had, and they traveled all over the world and were really revered and appreciated as the icon of Las Vegas, even though it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, Kate has a great story. Kate Gersten, who wrote the play and wrote the film, talks about 85 women on stage, 45 crew member, and like 15 people in the audience. You could just see it slowly disappear, that it just wasn't enough or you know, and it was replaced with all the circuses and Cirque du Soleil and things like that, which I love as well. But it must have been very hard on them. And to dedicate yourself so much, any dancer, I've talked to men and women in this world, in this industry, you know, acrobats even, who are like, you know, yeah, there was a, what do we do when it's all done? You don't think about it in the moment,
right?
You know, you don't have, like, you know, like Jamie Lee Curtis's character says, like, a, you know, 401k or things with, like, or even health insurance. I mean, they're doing it for the love of it, and usually dancers are treated fairly badly, actually, not kind of treasured as they should be.
How did they feel about this movie being made?
I think everyone's excited. I mean, so many people helped us in Las Vegas. We still have to do a screening for all the people that helped us there and the girls. I really can't wait to hear what they think. It's really important to me. But I love that this movie is about the working class in Las Vegas, who it takes to make Las Vegas shine. I mean, the reason that everybody comes. And Las Vegas during the day is its own character.
Right.
And I think that was really wonderful to explore and see. And I think about, who are the women holding up the rhinestones? I mean, they have relationships, they have kids, they have heartbreak, they have, the show must go on, they have, you know, pets, and they need to know what they're cooking for dinner.
Right.
And I just love that we got to experience all that through Shelley and through the other characters.
How was that for you? I mean, so many actors develop a process over the years of not only embodying the physical element of the character, but the mental. I know you said you were working with an acting coach. Have you developed that process for yourself, like having something like this to really sink your teeth into? Did you discover one?
I think I've been doing this my whole life. I've been playing characters my whole life. I've been, you know, dressing for other people, maybe in my relationships, or just being anything but me. And in the last few years, I really wanted to peel it back and say, who am I? Who am I? I mean, I know I can, I'm the best fantasy, brain, imagination. And so to actually apply what I've learned in, you know, acting class, but also reading plays. I was the one at Samuel French reading, you know, Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill plays when I was in Playboy, but I just didn't know how to get from there to there. So I've always been fascinated with the process. I always thought it's the best thing you can do is take an acting class. You learn so much about yourself. And I was just so happy to be able to sink my teeth into it. But, you know, you fear yourself. You think, you know, there's that imposter syndrome. It's like, no, you have to believe in yourself before others can believe in you. And you also have to take a risk. And I felt like with this film, I had nothing to lose. So I really wanted to just give it my all and apply everything I knew. And it's a lot of work, a lot of introspection. It's not easy. It takes risk. And, you know, I just loved every minute of it.
Tell me about that first day on set. What was the first thing you shot?
And oh my God.
How was that?
First scene we shot was around the dinner table. So we all got to know each other really quickly. I just wanted to be able to establish her in that moment. So we only have a few takes. We're shooting on film. And so I just, you know, I listen to music. I read over my notes. I do my emotional diaries about everything. I'm a writer, so I really put that to work. And after that scene was shot, I said, okay, I know who everybody is, and I know who I am. So that was really great. But also, like, when we did the table read, that was when I met Jamie Lee Curtis for the first time. And I was terrified because she just won an Academy Award. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe she's doing this. And, you know, I know Gia knows everybody because she's in this family of filmmakers, but I still was afraid to meet her. And she just grabbed me by the shoulders and she said, I did this for you.
Wow.
And so I was so touched and I thought, wow, okay, this is a sisterhood. Immediately, like, we've known each other our whole lives. This just, any of that worry went out the window. And then as we were doing the table read, she was on her second or third spray tan, I think, and she was changing colors before my eyes. So it was great. She's fearless, so am I.
How about deciding on Shelley's voice? Because it feels like there was intention behind it. I remember in your documentary, I don't know if they've, it just made me wonder, because in your documentary, when you were looking back at past videos, you said you could tell you were happy because of the tone of your voice. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, okay, when you were thinking about Shelley's voice, there's intention here. I assume I'm right on that. Talk a little bit about that.
Voice is really important to me. I can tell, even when I did the movie with Liam Neeson, which I did next, I knew our voices would be good together. I don't know, I just have an ear for voices, and I feel like when I do see myself in a certain era, I felt, oh, I feel strong then. Or when I see an interview back in the day and I was just so afraid, my voice goes higher. So it was, you know, just, I think there's a range of a comfortableness in a voice, and her voice ended up even having a little bit of a lisp at times. And I thought, I just went with it because it wasn't too, I didn't put too much thought into it, but it was just happening. So that was exciting because I felt like a real, I don't know where that comes from, but when you know, you do the work and then you, the character becomes the character and you're the character and they kind of, it just, and especially with such great writing and words and relationships, it was kind of just happened. But I noticed it too.
Mm-hmm.
When I watched the film,
uh-huh,
mostly.
How was it watching the film?
Well, we didn't watch it until TIFF. Gia wanted all of us to watch it together at TIFF with an audience on the big screen. So there were a lot of tears. Because we really bonded, we really, everyone dove in head first. It was a labor of love for everybody.
Were you proud of yourself?
I kind of was, because I could see that I transformed and that was what I wanted. I didn't want to see myself up there. I wanted to see Shelley. And a couple of the best compliments I've received, my kids too said something similar, but my friend, you know, Daniel Lismore was there. He's an incredible performance artist. And he said, you know, it was Shelley. You know, and just things like that. I was like, yeah, that's good. That's good. That's just, and I feel like I'm just scratching the surface and I want to do more, but I really want to do challenging roles. I want to do something that people would never think that I could do or that I could never think I'd do. So I'm really excited about it.
I know some of the girls stayed at the Rio, which is where much of this was shot. Were you able to, or?
I have a friend that had a house there, so I was able to stay there, but I brought everybody over to cook together because I thought that's a great bonding experience. So I taught all the girls how to make my famous roasted vegetable soup, put them all to work.
We could have been doing that right now.
We could have been doing that right now. But you said you're not very crafty.
I'm not.
You know, you said you make Christmas decorations, but you can cook.
I
Yeah, cooking is good. I think if you can, you're a good cook, you're good at large brands. You have good patience.
What's the specialty with your soup?
Oh, well, roasted vegetable soup. So I just think you need to get as many vegetables in you as you can. And so roasted vegetable soups makes it kind of a depth of flavor because you roast the vegetables and then you add them to the soup. So it's kind of a...
Was Jamie like, let me get in there?
Jamie wasn't there for that part. She could only be with us 4 days, 4 or 5 days. But I think the younger girls, I just a natural maternal instinct. Uh-huh. So I just, you know, just put my hooks around them and got them to work. Yeah, no, they were fantastic too. And they've been around for a long time. They've been in the business a very long time and are such pros.
Yeah. How about what is the Pamela Anderson day in Vegas like now versus 30 years ago?
Versus when I was a magician's assistant? Well, I was a magician's assistant for a few months in Las Vegas. I had a lot of wild friends come to visit me, like Amy Winehouse and you know, Lady Bunny. And I remember all the beehives in the front row where people couldn't see past them to see a show. Yeah, those were different days. But I'm glad I did it. And it kind of gave me a little taste of Las Vegas. I did it just for a short while. Had fire spikes driven through me. I was levitated 40 feet in the air.
How did this happen?
They just asked me to do it. And I mean, David LaChapelle did the poster. It was just really fun. It was kind of a family, my extended family thing. That was different. But I'm a mom. I look after my kids. I've had this kind of unorthodox way of getting here and my lifestyle and my career. But if I didn't have the career or the life that I had, I wouldn't be able to play Shelley the way I did.
Yeah.
So it was all worth it.
We talked earlier about the costuming, but these are like archival Bob Mackie costumes that like, you know, haven't been worn in some time. How was that to sort of step foot in that? Because I just think of like Lucy in that episode of I Love Lucy, where the headdress is just so heavy that she's like falling. Like, how did you step into that?
Well, they're heavy. They're heavy. And it's just that, you know, they haven't left the building in 30 years and they still had some women's name tags in them. So I knew I was carrying a lot of women that had wore this before me. And I don't know, it's kind of like, you know, it's just when you know people have done it before you, you feel like this confidence and you want to, it's just they felt there was magic in the costumes. But we were wearing the headdresses longer than most people would wear them. Usually you'd only wear them for a couple minutes on stage and you take them off. We were wearing them all day and kind of leaning against walls. The one that I wore at the very end, there was a backpack and there was the whole costume and the headdress. So,
uh-huh.
You know, they kind of jab into you, they're sharp, they're heavy, but it's so cool to be able to wear them.
And how do you make it look like you've been doing it for 30 years, the taking, like, and, you know, putting them on?
Well, that
take a lot of work?
We just had to do it. I mean, we just had to do it. I remember, you know, Jean going, okay, now that we had dialogue and we were taking on and off the costumes and we had to match that a couple different times. So it was choreography. You had to remember it. It was like a dance. I mean, the movie feels very musical in its own way because we didn't have much time. We did really long shots too and long scenes and had a lot to do in them.
Well, the film opens and ends with this audition of Shelley, you know, trying to find another gig of a more modern show.
Yeah.
And once again, her fate sort of is in the hands of a man telling her, you know, you're not it. You're not what we're looking for. This is what we want. And I'm curious, what's a moment that stands out for you of something similar?
In my whole career, parts of it are, I mean, I just could tell you so many things that I wouldn't really want to end up being salacious headlines. So, but I think it's, you have to navigate it best you can. I always felt like Miss Magoo. Somehow I navigated it unscathed. But also this business is full of rejection and people, you know, just dismay, disregard you. And I feel like this movie really is about second chances. So I think it's a hopeful film. And even though the business is tough, you have to protect yourself. You learn how to do that without becoming jaded or bitter because that's no fun to watch. I mean, you want to be the hero of your own story. And I think that's how I feel about my life and how I feel Shelley has navigated hers.
The sort of heart of this film is the relationship Shelley has with her daughter. And, you know, it's a strange relationship. And your daughter's played by Billie Lourd. Her character's name is Hannah. And, you know, there's a moment where she comes to see the show, and her reaction is one of, this is what you sort of put above me. Like, she's really upset by it and somewhat embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
And not really understanding the other side of why Shelley made these choices for, you know, so she could have a better life. And I'm curious for you, I mean, what have your conversations been like, you know, with your sons about your image, whether because of choices you made or choices out of your control? Like, how did you navigate similar conversations?
Well, I used to always think I would talk to my kids when it was age appropriate with certain things that had happened to me or to their father or to all of us as a family. And it always ended up that they would hear about it first, and then you're just doing damage control and you're trying to protect them from everybody. Like, you know, it's unfortunately, there's no easy way and there's no perfect way to do that. But I find we've had a lot of conversations about things as now that they're adults. It's those teenage years that are the harder ones. But as an adult, this is why Brandon wanted to produce that documentary. He really wanted people to know who I was and not be the brunt of the joke anymore. And I only ever wanted to make them proud. So when I saw them front row, when I played Roxy and they were there at the opening, and to see such pride in their face, I mean, that just meant everything to me. And they're very proud of me and very proud of this film. So we've turned the corner, but those are hard conversations to have. And I think all of us will have to face our adult children and beg. And, you know, like, there's just no easy way. And kids always want, part of their struggle is their parents and the, you know, that friction and why this, why that. And, you know, just they just have to know that they're loved and that you did everything with love. Love is the most, is the only way through.
I know we've seen how important journaling is for you and what you're able to work through in that. And you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you did some of that during this. Can you talk to me about like what the journaling looked like in maybe the lead up, in the process, and in the aftermath, and what did that reveal to you?
I've always been a journaler. I think it really helped me a lot in my life. I could figure out what I was thinking if I could write it down. And I just write like stream of consciousness. And people always say, oh, you wrote me a poem. I go, no, I didn't. I just wrote you a text. What are you talking about? So I have this kind of way that I write. And I think with Shelley, you know, I wanted to know, I just really ask big questions to myself. And then I would just write until the page ended. And then you read it back. It's kind of like an exercise almost. A certain process that you can do is replace different characters with different people in your personal life. So you really can think about those people and write everything out. So then when I'm doing my scene with Dave, you know, I could be thinking about somebody else at first, and then, you know, you do this replacement, but then you bring it back to the character. I don't know. I mean, I'm still learning everything. I'm like a sponge, though, and I'm just very excited about all these methods of how to find and the character and how to make all those nuances and layers real. So I experimented with everything, but writing was a huge thing. I wrote every day, and I always write every day, but I mean, I wrote multiple things a day, and I have my little journal that I've kept, but
I was going to say, was it just one journal? Did you pack like three?
Oh my gosh, I have just stacks of paper, stacks. And I like to handwrite stuff, especially for that kind of thing.
You set out really, like you said in the top of this conversation, but in your documentary, like, I want people to see me differently. I mean, you were one of the most famous women of the 90s. The level of interest in your personal life, in your marriages, in your body was intense.
I've only been married four times by now, not six. Let's just correct Wikipedia right now.
What's corrected here.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, what the level of attention that you're getting for a film like this and your performance in this, how that compares to what you experienced before. How are you processing it?
I'm just so grateful that I actually got to do something that I'm capable of and that I can be looked at as an actor or as an artist instead of this one-dimensional person. But, you know, I fed into that. What I did was, when I started getting a lot of attention on Baywatch, I started sharing the attention with animal rights and animal issues, because I just couldn't wrap my head around so much attention about such bizarre things like your boyfriends or, you know, your boobs. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share this attention with something more meaningful. So, yes, I was used to a lot of attention, but it didn't feel good. It didn't feel right. It just felt you know, there's so much more. I felt like I was so much more and I had so much more to give. But I didn't, you know, no complaints. I mean, being a part of pop culture is a blessing. It's also a little bit of a curse, I guess, if you're wanting to do more. But, you know, you just kind of got to navigate it. And I think with me, you know, being in my garden and peeling it all back and discovering who I am and who I was at 5 years old, like what, who am I? What are my original thoughts and my dreams? I have been living that way in my personal life, and I think that's helping maybe people see me in a new way too. It's not really, you know, this isn't like a game, it's authentic. So, but I'm looking at it, if I look at it as an outsider, I could see that it's all complementing each other and it's all part of it.
Well, before I let you go, you do have a new film that's coming soon with Liam Neeson.
Yes.
Naked Gun. How was that for you?
It was a blast. It was fun to do that right out of doing Showgirl. I went into The Naked Gun with Liam. And Liam is, you know, he's legend and he's so lovely and such a talent and so funny. Mm-hmm. Like you can't keep a straight face with him. He's so funny. But I think, you know, he's Irish. Everyone's funny. But he's really charming. It was a blast. We had so much fun. And Akiva Schaffer, the director, just the physical comedy and the SNL guys that were there. Yeah. We had a blast.
The journal entries are more light with this one?
Yes. Yeah, no, but still, you do just as hard work. Hard work, it's hard to do a high comedy. It's hard to do
horror
drama. I mean, it's you would take it just as seriously and you work just as hard. And there's a love story, so it was fun to kind of explore that too, which was, you know, you put a lot into it. You got to do, I feel like I've just scratched the surface. I'm just beginning. This is my, just the beginning. All of that was boot camp. Now I'm here.
Who's the wish list? What director or other star would you like to work with?
Oh my God, everybody. All of them. I want to do a lot. It's something that's hard to even wrap my head around yet because I couldn't believe that I'm in this position, surrounded by these people, walking into rooms with, you know, Nicole Kidman and you know, these great actors. And you know, it's hard to imagine me there, but I'm trying really hard to be confident and walk up to people and shake their hand and be proud of where I am right now. But it's definitely not easy. But I'm soaking it up and I'm doing my best to be, you know, around everybody that's been on my, you know, icons too.
Well, it was a stunning performance. Congratulations and best of luck on this next chapter. I think you're off to a great start.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
After the break, Mark's conversation with John Magaro from September 5.
For the Los Angeles Times and the Envelope podcast, I'm Mark Olson, and we're here today with John Magaro, one of the stars of September 5.
It's great to be here.
I've seen in some past interviews that you often don't like to watch yourself in movies. So have you actually watched September 5th?
Yeah. I'm not a complete weirdo. I do watch everything. I always watch everything. But I tend not to revisit it much. And there's a lot of my colleagues who will sit through several screenings of it. I prefer to just watch it in a screening room kind of by myself. When I'm in a crowd with other people, I find myself focusing on their reaction as opposed to the movie. So it's not really an experience where I'm really letting the movie hit me. Instead, I'm listening. Are they reacting the way I thought they would? And I just don't find it a healthy thing for me as an actor. But I definitely watch it, and I go back and revisit it and try and learn lessons from each performance to better myself as an actor. That's just the way I go about it.
And how did you feel about it when you watched September 5? And in part, I'm asking because, like, for viewers who weren't part of the production, the movie itself is so surprising, just like what it is.
Yeah.
And so I'm so curious what the experience is like for you of watching the film.
I mean, I was impressed. I was very impressed. But I think for all of us, the first time, no matter what you do, if you're a DP, if you're a costume designer, you tend to the first time you watch it, you tend to focus on things you were like, I could have done that a little differently, or this a little differently, or I wish they would have used this take, or... But this one, it was actually pretty, I was pretty impressed. I was very impressed. I was amazed how fast it went. And I was really amazed because we were in that little space, this tiny space, and I was definitely worried, is this going to be able to hold people's attention and be thrilling? Or is it going to be boring because we're just in this one room? And I was amazed. And I think that's in large part because of Hans-Jörg, our editor. He was able to create this tone, this frenetic tone that was just driving and kept you engaged. And I really have to give him a ton of credit for piecing this together, because it couldn't have been easy. There was a ton of footage and it was a huge challenge.
The events depicted in the movie, the hostage crisis at the 1972 Olympics, has been depicted in films many times. The documentary One Day in September, of course, Munich. Sure. And now you actually have a small role in Munich?
If you can call it that. I was I was background in Munich. Yeah, that was, I had just moved to New York. It was 20 years ago, right? 2004, yeah. 2005, it came up. It was nominated for Best Picture in 2005. Back when they had five Best Picture nominees. I was fresh off the boat, had a theater degree in hand, which basically meaningless. And I was pounding pavement. I got, you can get your headshots printed and you staple on your resume, you send it to anyone you know, who's your mom's best friend, if she'll live, you know, like, doesn't matter. And I sent it to background casting directors too, because I just wanted to be on a set. Up until that point, I had only really done theater. Mm-hmm. No long camera experience at all. So I got a call saying, do you want to work 2 days on a Steven Spielberg movie? And it didn't matter how small the thing was, I was excited to be there. And yeah, if you watch, it's in Brooklyn, so it's I think it's towards the end of the movie when Eric Bana is, he's all paranoid and whatever, and he feels like he's being chased on the streets of Brooklyn. And if you watch, he's crossing the street with his daughter, and then you see, my hair used to have like really long curly hair. You see me so skinny, like a little rail, walking across the street, and trying not to look at the camera. And it was fascinating. It was fascinating to be on a movie set to begin with, but then see Steven Spielberg from a distance. Tony Kushner, it was surreal.
Mm-hmm. Moving forward to September 5, like the way in which the film tells the story, the way in which it chooses this just tiny sort of sliver of the larger story, when you first read the screenplay, were you surprised by that? Like the way in which September 5 chooses to just focus on the ABC sports aspect of the story?
I thought that was fascinating. That's one of the things that drew me to it. You know, because we've seen Munich. We know the aftermath. We've seen One Day in September, which sort of covers the media a little bit, but it's a lot more than that. But this was a kind of a revelation, and it was certainly an education for me. There was so much that I didn't know about that day there. And I think I keep hearing that from people who see it. They remember where they were that day, and they remember Jim McKay, but a lot of people keep telling me they don't remember them coming and saying that they were okay and then that news being reversed. They don't remember that it was 22 hours. And many people don't remember that this was the first time there was an event like this, a horrible, tragic event that was shared in real time throughout the entire world.
We're making broadcast history. More people have seen this and watched Armstrong land on the moon.
There are police on the roof.
Oh, guys, that's a TV. Or are they seeing what we're seeing?
What are you talking about?
Are the terrorists seeing this?
On paper, this is a really unusual project. It's this relatively unknown Swiss filmmaker. The film's shooting in Germany. It has this international cast. Like, what? When you kind of get that, you know, as a, you know, a project, what do you make of all that?
Sometimes you have to take a risk. I like to take a risk in what I do. But I will say, when I was sent the script, Sean Penn was on as a producer. Peter Sarsgaard was attached. So I had a feeling there must be something here. And then I read those words. And yeah, you know, Tim had done sci-fi stuff before, so this was different. It was German producers who I didn't really know. It was going to Munich for a few months. But sometimes, when you read something and you feel like there's something there, you got to take a leap of faith. I mean, I've done that a lot in my career. And I really like, you know, Tim, it wasn't his first film, but it's his kind of his first. He's done an English film before, but this is totally unique and new for him. So you take that risk and you trust in their vision, you trust in their words. And because I believed in it, I was willing to jump with him.
And when you do you feel like in the past when you've taken that risk that it has paid off for you?
To varying degrees. There have been some times where no, it doesn't. You know, I've had my share of failures and things that I hoped would work. And you know, it's a miracle to put a film together. It's a miracle any film gets made, especially nowadays. But it's hard. There's so many ways to mess it up. So if you can make it to the finish line and get it right, I mean, that is a miracle of miracles. So yeah, sometimes it hasn't gone this way, but I've also been very lucky. I mean, last year with Past Lives was very similar. You know, an untested playwright who wrote a remarkable script. A24 believed in it, so they were behind it, but we had no idea where that was going to land. Mm. So that was just a complete surprise that it resonated so strongly with people.
I know with this, especially given it's, you know, a fact-based story, where do you start? Like, are you big on research? Like, what do you do to kind of like get started?
Every job is different. And every source of inspiration is different. I always encourage directors to send me things that are inspiring them, whether it be art or music or books or pictures, anything. And Tim did do some of that. He did send me stuff. But my real key into this one was Jeff Mason. Having him around and having him to talk to and becoming friends with him and earning his trust to play him was a huge step along the way. I knew he was apprehensive. We talked and you could sense it. You could sense this fear of this huge moment. I mean, career changing for him. It changed his career. He went on to be, you know, the head of NBC Sports. He's revered in the industry. And it all kind of started on that day. But he lived through this with these other people, this team, this control room, right, who had been going back and forth between New York and Munich, setting up shop, really, like setting up, building from nothing, a broadcast facility that for the first time was going to transmit images of the Olympics to people all over the world. There was such excitement with that. And then all of a sudden, they hit an iceberg in a way, and it goes terribly wrong. So I felt like talking to him, he was really concerned that we get it right, that our heart was in the right place, and that we honored all the other people around him too. Everyone else who had gone through it, who had put all that hard work into it. And I also sensed like he didn't want the spotlight shined on him so much. He would have rather it been someone else, but he was the one who told Tim the story, so he was the one who was going to be showcased. But he was so helpful to me. He really made it clear, painted such a clear picture of what it was like that day, how to approach it. And I wanted it to be as authentic as possible, as real as it could be. And I encouraged him that's the way I was going, and I think that sort of put his mind at ease. And then when he saw how excited I was to do the research, how to get into control rooms, to learn how to call a show, to work with the props, to make them like an extension of my limbs. I think he really started to see my dedication and trust me. And as he saw dailies come in, he just kept, you know, reassuring me we were on the right path and that it was reminding him of what it was like. And he's become now a champion of the film.
There must have been such a difficult position to be in where, like, on the one hand, you're talking to him, wanting to, like, learn from him, take things from him, but then there's also a way you're almost, like, having to reassure him and, I don't want to say talk him into it, but, like, be sure that he feels good about it, too.
In a way, yeah. But it's, you know, it's totally understandable. I mean, I couldn't imagine having someone play you in a moment like that. But what I'm also really thankful for is that Jeff was so open about it and open about his apprehension to it. Because I oftentimes feel like, and I've played people where family has been around or other people have been around and And sometimes it's hard for them to let go. They want them themselves portrayed in a very specific way. And because Jeff was more concerned about the other people, like he really, there's this, the guy Don Allmeyer, who was, Jeff in this movie is kind of an amalgamation of two people. It really is Jeff, but on the day, there was actually a director next to him calling the show. His name is Don Allmeyer. And Jeff was really concerned that he wasn't in it. So just to pay like the slightest bit of homage to Don, if in the beginning of the film, there's another director who is going to the Alps with his family who's out. And we made that Don because we really wanted everyone to be included and not to feel Hollywood and not to feel like we were, you know, leaving people behind. So those things, I think made Jeff happy. And we were able to do that because he was so open and honest with what he had been through.
Mm. And then also you did spend time like watching current live productions. Like you went to some football games, I think, or sports.
I spent 2 months at CBS Sunday Football shadowing the directors and the producers, being in the control room. So learning that language, because it's so specific. And anyone who's been in those rooms like sees right through if it's not what it's supposed to be. But beyond just shadowing them, I was, you know, in the CBS facility on 57th Street in New York where I live, and I was seeing, you know, the wiring and the bowels of the building and the old equipment and the graphics department, the sound department, the music department, meeting the on-air personalities. But I'm a Steelers fan, and Bill Cowher is one of their hosts. So that was really cool that I got to meet him. And my dad has passed away, but like Bill Cowher was a legend to him. So I got to share that with them. And on top of that, meeting Sean McManus, who's Jim McKay's son, because he ran CBS Sports. So getting to talk to him, a guy who was there in Munich, a young man at the time, but there and in the rooms and knew Jeff and told me what it was like. And it just gave me such access and such an awareness of what it meant to be part of that world and what it meant to call a show.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's funny, as much as the story is like focused on what's happening in that control room, some of my favorite moments in the movie, I like every time you all step out into the hall when you have these kind of like sidebar
meetings, yeah.
conversations. Yeah. Like those I think are some really terrific moments. Mm. And there's one in particular when it's later in the film, some mistakes have been made. There's a real air of desperation to your character, to Jeff. And he says, this is our chance to get it right. And I know for myself, like I knew that feeling all too well. Like when you feel that a story is like slipping away from me and you're desperately trying to like get back hold of it.
Yeah, that's at the end. That's right before they find out officially that they had died. There's a kind of rumblings of that, and they sort of sense that's the direction things are going. And Jeff, you know, is that, as Marvin and Ben Chaplin's character and Peter's character, Rune Arledge, have come to terms with that's what's going to happen. They're going to find out that it's all gone terribly wrong. And then you have Jeff, this young man who's hungry and hopeful and excited, trying to chase down every lead possible because he still has someone in the field. Like, maybe we could get a report from them. Maybe it isn't true. But of course it is. And then he's pushed into having to deliver that news to Jim McKay, which, again, talking to Jeff Mason, that is pretty spot on to how that went down.
Mm.
Yeah, going into getting the news, the phone call, going over and being like, Jim, they're all gone. You got to report this.
That's another thing is just, I think we all would hope that, you know, if we find ourselves in a moment where we're maybe out of our comfort zone or experience level, a little over our heads maybe, that we could rise to the occasion in the way that Jeff seems to in the moment.
You'd hope, but I think there's something in the blood of people who deal with crises as a job. You know, I've been saying like a pilot, when there's a problem on a plane, like you have to keep your wits about you, right? That's the training. And I think even though they weren't news broadcasters and they were sports broadcasters, I talked to Jeff, there had been crises before, nothing like this. But when you have a sporting event, sometimes people get injured, sometimes you don't know if they're okay or not. So you have an awareness how to sort of navigate potential life and death situations. And I think that, and also just, they were journalists at the end of the day. You know, they weren't the news team, but they had the training. And Roone, you know, he went on to be the head of ABC News. So I think once those gunshots went off and they were aware of what was going on, the training kicked in. And they, you know, it's like in Sully when he like lands the plane. Mm-hmm. Like it's that they knew what to do. They knew they had to stay on the air and they were capable of doing it. I mean, obviously ABC News wanted to take it from them, but they weren't going to give it up. And that's why media was changed forever. I mean, if they would have given that story back to New York and not been the ones running it, it would have been covered entirely differently. And it's wild to think that because Roone insisted on keeping it, that's when media changed.
There has been some conversation around the film about the fact that it stays so tightly focused on ABC Sports, what's happening in that control room, and doesn't really get into the larger picture of the events that are being depicted.
Right.
How do you feel about that? Like,
I mean, I think that's a choice. I think it's strange when people try and rewrite a movie.
Yeah.
You know, this is what Tim wanted to do. Tim thought about doing a much more sweeping story. He had ideas of doing this story that had dealt with the police and the athletes and the Palestinians and the Israelis and this and that. And really, in a lot of ways, because of budget constraints, and it's an independent film, that movie that's covering all of that from the Munich perspective, you know, that's a big studio movie. That's a $100 million movie, probably. This movie, he wanted to make something about Munich with the resources he had. And after his conversations with Jeff Mason, he realized that there was something intriguing about this moment where news media was altered forever. I mean, it's something we live with constantly nowadays, right? So that was the story Tim wanted to tell. It wasn't about judging one side or the other. It wasn't about in the geopolitical context of things. It was about telling the story of what went on in the room that day. And I think that's kind of audacious and bold. Listen, this happened, we shot this before October 7th. But that crisis is still going on. It's been going on since 48. It's going on for millennia, you could even say. So there was awareness of those sensitivities, but Tim was never trying to approach it from that perspective. I would argue this was bound to happen in media at some point, whether it was Israel-Palestine, whether it was an African dictatorship and against its people, whether it was something in America. It was going to there was going to be a moment where globally a tragedy was going to be shared. It just so happens that this was the moment it was shared.
One of the things that's so remarkable in the movie is that you get this great cast of characters, the rest of the crew, and you get this sense that they're this, you know, it's an international team that's working. I particularly like the performance by Liane Binash as a German translator. And she, I mean, she'd got some attention for her film, The Teacher's Lounge, a year or two ago. But she also is someone who like really comes alive in this.
Yeah, I mean, top to bottom, we had an amazing cast. And I'm including our background actors in that because they were there every single day with us. And they had stayed just as alive and just as focused as every principal was. And then even the other people like Benjamin Walker, who had probably, I think, the hardest job in emulating Peter Jennings, a young Peter Jennings. And then, it was just across the board. And obviously Leone, who offers the German perspective, which is such an important component of this story, especially because, you know, it's produced by Germans. It kind of in a lot of ways is a German film. And that moment is still like a big scar for a lot of that generation of Germany because they're trying to pick up the pieces of this disaster their parents had given them. They're trying to reintroduce themselves to the world. The Happy Olympics is what they called it. And, you know, that's why there were no armed guards around. That's why it was so casual. They didn't think of the consequences of that and they just weren't prepared for it. And I think Leone, in that scene at the end that we have, which was a scene that took a lot of time to figure out, we shot it actually once before and we had to come back to it because we realized something just wasn't right. And through discussions with Leonie, Tim, and I, and honestly doing an exercise of like, what would you really say in this moment? We got to a place where it was just the right amount that needed to be said without hammering a message over the audience's head. But she is such a brilliant actress. She's so smart and she's so present. And yeah, it was a great fortune to have her there.
And do you like that, to get that chance to like go back and try it again?
You know, I prefer not to, actually. I prefer leaving it. But if something isn't right, that's the great thing about film, is you can have an opportunity to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes also, it's sometimes hard for actors and directors and producers to do that, because it's kind of acknowledging defeat in a way. But if you don't do that, if you don't acknowledge that you don't have it right and you're trying to fit the square peg into the round hole, then you're gonna fuck up your whole movie. So I feel really lucky that we had artists who were willing to look at things with fresh eyes daily. And in the moment when we were shooting it. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why the film is so strong.
And then to take a step back just a little bit, you know, you've been acting now for over 10 years.
20 years. 20 years. Professionally, 20, because 2005,
yeah.
Munich.
Yeah.
20, yeah, I'm an old man now.
But it does seem like just the past few years with First Cow and then Past Lives, now with September 5, that things have really kind of suddenly picked up for you. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, listen, I'm not sweating going broke tomorrow. And there were many times where I was, you know, eating $1 pizza slices and not knowing when the next paycheck was going to come. I've always been lucky getting all the way down there, that something has picked up for me, and knock on wood, that continues. But it's a weird thing, you know? I came into this, I grew up in Cleveland. My parents were teachers. This started as a hobby for me. I didn't really know anything. I went to school for it, and then I really gained a love and an appreciation for it. And I went to New York, you know, thinking maybe I'll be a regional theater actor or something like that. That's what I knew. And I fell into commercials, and I did some commercials, and then I started doing TV, and then I started doing film. And all that time, I would go to this bar called McCoy's on West Side in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan. And it was a place that on Tuesday nights, and since COVID, it hasn't quite been the same, it's a place that actors, a lot of journeyman actors, would come to and play poker on Tuesday nights. A lot of people who were working on Broadway would come after shows. I was introduced to it from a guy, a friend of mine, who I met doing a play in Pittsburgh. And when I moved to New York, he was kind enough to introduce me into this world. And it was a place like Paul Rudd would go and play, John Hamm before he got Mad Men, another friend of mine, Dylan Baker, like these kinds. So all across the Joe Latrullio, like people like that. Like, so it was these people that I had seen and really respected and looked up to, because they were these journeyman actors. And I would just want to be around them, because even when I wasn't working, I felt like I was part of a community of like-minded kind of people. And like, I would just be the kid, you know, bringing them drinks to the table, like Spider and Goodfellas. Luckily no one shot my foot, but it was like that. But it kind of became like my church in my early 20s, of a place to go talk to other actors, learn what it means, learn what it takes. And it really got me through some really hard times. And in a lot of ways, it prepared me for where I'm at now in my career. And it gave me the fortitude to get through the bad times and continue on. But it's been a journey. That's how I always saw it. And luckily, I'm willing to keep climbing that ladder and keep trying to get better as I go. And I've also been afforded a lot of opportunities to make mistakes and get back up and learn how to be a better actor.
And you had mentioned Past Lives earlier, and how that movie, you know, kind of took on a life that you weren't expecting. Mm. What was it like to sort of go through that, to see a movie kind of that scale, like go to where it did?
It's wild. I mean, I don't even know how to put it in words. I mean, I had been at the Oscars once before with the Big Short, which, you know, that made sense because I had huge people in it. So that was a little less surprising that we made it to that. Something like Past Lives. with an untested director, you know, we never thought. We were happy when we got into Sundance. And that was a huge win. And then all of a sudden we play Sundance and then there's this excitement around it. It was crazy. It was crazy that it went all that way. And what's so special about films like that and from people I talked to about September 5 is when you make a film like that, this like an indie, where it's all about the heart, where it's not a commodity, really. Like, if you make money, you make money. If you don't, not a big deal. Taking that and showing it to audiences and having them react so passionately, having them come up to you with past lives and being like, oh, yeah, that reminded me of the love that I lost. And with this being like, this reminds me of where I was that day. This is making me look at how I watched news with fresh perspective. That's you hope to affect people. You hope to maybe change people in a way. I mean, obviously entertain people, but you realize how much more this can be.
And then it's funny, I just did an interview with Justin Karitzkis.
I just saw him last night.
Oh, really?
We were at the Governor's Awards and I kept going around. I played this guy in a movie. That's what I would say.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you is that, did you feel that when you were shooting the movie? I mean, Celine has talked a lot about how that story is very personal to her, but it does feel like you're playing a, like, I'm just curious, like, did you feel like you were playing him in some way?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, but I think Celine cast me because in a lot of ways I remind her of him. And Justin and I are you know, very friendly now, and, you know, we're going to have dinner when we're back in New York. And it wasn't that much of a stretch. You know, I'm married to a Korean woman. We have a kid now. So that story was very close to me. And even in our early, you know, we had them over to our house for dinner right after I was cast. And the stories we kept sharing, there was a lot of similarities in them. So that gave me a confidence in going into that film. But again, you never know how it's going to land. I'm glad it landed well.
And then I want to be sure just to ask you about your relationship with Kelly Riker. She's one of my favorite.
Who? Never heard of her. Yeah.
She's one of my favorite filmmakers. The movies you made with her so far, First Cow and Showing Off, are both so terrific.
Well, we're about to do another one. I'm hopping on a plane right after this to go and shoot one more with Kelly called Mastermind.
And what is it that you like about working with her? Like to you, what makes her special as a filmmaker?
I mean, just watch one of her movies. You just got to watch a Kelly Reichardt movie and you know she's special. She's doing something nobody else is doing. She has a singular voice. That's why she is the definition of an auteur. I mean, that is what, like, there have been many in the past, but nowadays I'd almost put her picture next to that word as a definition. And on top of that, she's super cool. And I just love being around her. That's why people keep going back and working with her. That's why Chris Blauvelt shoots every movie she does. That's why people who get a call, Michelle Williams, but that's why people who haven't worked with her get a call and want to be there. She just creates a family and she makes really great movies. And for an actor, it's just fun to be a part of.
One more thing, it's funny. I think it speaks to what an exciting time this is for your career that, like, I'm looking at, like, the things you have coming up and, like, I literally want to ask you about all of them. So that you're also in Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride?
Not quite a Nepo hire, but it was, I will say, I owe 15% of my money to Peter Sarsgaard. He's the reason I got that part. Which I guess means I didn't annoy him too much on September 5. That's a wild one. It's bold, and I'm really excited for people to see it. There's no way to describe it. I mean, it's like Badlands. I'll try. It's like Badlands mixed with Bonnie and Clyde, mixed with young Frankenstein, mixed with Frankenstein, mixed with a Gene Kelly movie. It's nuts.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just got to see it to believe it.
And then just the last thing, also, you mentioned earlier the agency series that you're in. What can you tell me about that?
So it's based on a really loved French show called Le Bureau, and this is the American version of it. It's about the CIA. It's kind of what it takes to be a CIA agent. It's not about like being James Bond, but it's about the psychological toll of living as someone else and coming back and having to pick up where you left off after 6 years and your relationships, what that means, being fake, you know, are you ever truly real? And Michael Fassbender leads our cast and he's absolutely wonderful in it. Jeffrey Wright, Richard Gere, Jodie Turner-Smith, Catherine Waterson. I mean, it's just a monster cast, and Joe Wright directed our first episodes, and I think it's going to be really unique. And if you've seen Le Bureau, you know, this is similar, but obviously it's American, and it also is dealing with the current geopolitical crises that we're going through.
And then how do you like the distinction between doing a series versus doing a movie?
I think not for series like that. The lines have become so blurred. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like shooting a movie. It's not like the old days of 22 episodes on network TV where you're just pumping things out. This is, you know, it's the Butterworths wrote these scripts. So, you know, you have a playwright, great writers mm-hmm. writing these scripts. So, yeah, the lines are blurred.
Well, the new movie is September 5. John Magaro, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Catch us again with more new episodes after the Oscar nominations.